Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you haven't already, please make sure you subscribe. Today, we're going to be tackling Eric Ries's The Lean Startup.
Oh, excellent choice.
Yeah, you know, you might be thinking another business book.
Yeah.
But trust me, this one is, well, it's different. It's actually packed with like actionable insights that can apply to, well, anyone, really, not just, you know, tech moguls or whatever.
That's true. I mean, the Lean Startup, it's really more of a mindset shift than just like a how-to guide. It's about approaching any new venture, you know, with that framework that really prioritizes learning and adaptation.
Right. Okay, so let's unpack that a little bit. Right off the bat, like from the get-go, Ries defines a startup in a very specific way.
Yeah.
So what makes a startup different from just any small business?
You hit the nail on the head there. It's all about the, you know, extreme uncertainty. Startups aren't just selling a product in a local market. You know what I mean? They're trying to solve problems that might not even have solutions yet. I like to think of it as exploring uncharted territory. You need a different approach than if you were following a well-worn path.
So it's not about size. It's about navigating the unknown. And Ries isn't afraid to say that a lot of startups fail.
Yeah.
What's the biggest reason they do?
You know, the biggest pitfall is clinging to a rigid plan. It's tempting to, like, meticulously craft this big business plan and just stick to it no matter what, right?
Right.
But the reality is that startups, they need to be flexible. They need to adapt as they, you know, gather new information and learn from the mistakes they make along the way.
Makes total sense. You can't predict every twist and turn when you're, like, forging a new path. You've got to be able to adjust course.
Yeah.
So how does the Lean Startup method actually help with that? What are, like, the key principles?
Well, at its core, it's all about this cycle of build, measure, learn. So first, you build a minimum viable product, which is also known as an MVP. And that's really just the simplest version of your idea that you can use to test with real customers.
So it's like a prototype, but with a focus on getting it into the hands of users ASAP.
Exactly. It's about getting feedback, not like achieving perfection right off the bat. Then you measure how customers interact with the MVP. So you're collecting data, you know, what works, what doesn't. And finally, well, you learn from that feedback and then you use it to improve your product, maybe even pivot in a new direction entirely.
I see. So Ries actually illustrates this really well with that example of the company IMVU. They launched this 3D avatar chat program that, well, in their own words, was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of giving up, they did something really interesting.
Yeah, what they did was they shipped new versions of the product every single day. Can you believe that?
Wow.
They incorporated customer feedback with each iteration. So it was this constant cycle of building, measuring, and learning. And this relentless focus on the user feedback allowed them to, you know, take their initial, let's be honest, terrible product and turn it into a really successful platform.
That's amazing. That's a perfect example of how embracing rapid iteration can lead to breakthroughs.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just for tech companies, is it? I mean, Ries, he highlights examples from like all sorts of different industries.
Well, absolutely. One that comes to mind is Zappos, you know, the online shoe retailer.
Mm.
Well, they started by just literally posting pictures of shoes from local stores online to see if people would actually, you know, buy them without trying them on. It was like the most bare bones MVP ever, but it, you know, it worked. It validated their core assumption.
Wow.
And it really did set the stage for, well, for their incredible growth.
It's incredible to think that a company like Zappos started with, well, with such a simple experiment. And Ries really emphasizes that even, you know, established companies, they can benefit from these lean startup principles.
Oh, yeah, for sure. He actually uses the example of Intuit, the company behind TurboTax.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So what they did was they created a mobile app, SnapTax, and they did this by, like, forming this small independent team that operated basically like a mini startup within the larger organization.
I see.
Ries calls this an island of freedom.
Okay.
And that basically allowed them to rapidly experiment and iterate without getting bogged down by all the, you know, corporate bureaucracy.
So it's like injecting this dose of startup agility into a more traditional structure. This really highlights the, like, the adaptability of the lean startup method. But not every experiment leads to success right away. You know, Ries talks about this company called Grokket that had to make some really, like, tough decisions based on their data.
Yes, Grokket was this online test prep platform. They initially assumed, you know, more features equals more engagement, right?
Right.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
But through A/B testing, they actually found that some of the features they thought were super important were actually having, like, no impact at all.
Right.
Yeah, and it was this realization that led them to, well, to pivot their focus. They shifted to marketing and positioning, which ultimately turned out to be a much more effective growth strategy.
This is where that that idea of validated learning comes in, right?
Exactly.
It's about testing your assumptions with, well, with real data, not just going on your intuition or guesswork.
Yeah.
It's about letting the evidence guide your decisions. And that can sometimes lead to, well, to pivots, unexpected course corrections.
Precisely. And you know what? That brings us to one of the like key tenets of this whole lean startup method, the minimum viable product, or MVP, as they call it.
Okay, so let's talk MVPs. It sounds like, well, it sounds like it's really the heart of the lean startup approach.
You're absolutely right. It's about getting something, anything out there quickly, even if it's not perfect, to start gathering that feedback from customers.
But how do you know what to include in an MVP? It must be tempting to, you know, try to cram in all the features that you like envision for the final product.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. But that's actually a common trap. You know, the beauty of an MVP is like its simplicity. It's all about identifying the core value of your product and then building like the most basic version that allows you to test it with real users.
So are there like different types of MVPs? Because I imagine the approach might be different depending on, you know, the product or service.
Oh, you're spot on. Rees, he actually describes several different types. One of them is called the concierge MVP.
Concierge MVP.
Yeah. Think of it like this. Let's say you're building this super sophisticated software platform. Instead of trying to like build the whole thing up front, which would take forever, right? You could start by like manually providing that service to just a small handful of customers.
So you're basically acting as the product, like behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Just to validate the core concept.
Bingo. That's it. That's actually what this company, Food on the Table, did. They help families plan meals and grocery shopping. Initially, they didn't have any fancy algorithms or like software or anything. Instead, they had like a team of people who personally created meal plans and grocery lists for their customers.
Interesting.
This allowed them to learn a lot about customer needs and preferences before, you know, before investing all that time and money into building a complex technology platform.
That's such a smart example of how you can test a concept and get real world feedback without, you know, building a fully functional product. It's about being resourceful and it's about, you know, focusing on learning, right?
Absolutely. And speaking of learning, you know, this whole focus on learning is actually central to another key concept, innovation accounting.
Okay. Innovation accounting. It sounds a little intimidating if I'm being honest. What is that all about?
Well, it's really not that complicated. It's basically about recognizing that, you know, traditional accounting methods, those that focus on, you know, revenue and profit, they're not always a good fit for startups.
Right, because early stage startups, they're often, well, they're more focused on, you know, growth and learning, not necessarily profitability.
Exactly. So innovation accounting, what it does is it focuses on measuring what matters most in those like really early stages, you know, the learning and the progress. It's about tracking things like how quickly you're validating your assumptions, iterating on the product, and acquiring those first customers.
So instead of just looking at like the bottom line, you know, your bank account, you're looking at things like customer engagement, the feedback you're getting, and how fast you're adapting to, you know, to new information.
Exactly. Aligning your metrics with like the true goals as a startup.
Okay. So this all makes sense, but there's this big question that, well, it's kind of lingering. What happens when the data tells you it's time to make like a big change?
That's the million-dollar question, right? That brings us to the crucial decision that, well, that every startup faces. Pivot or persevere.
Yeah.
It really is a tough one. It's about recognizing when your initial assumptions, you know, they just aren't panning out, and then having the courage to, you know, to actually change direction.
So it's not giving up. It's being agile, right?
Yeah.
Being responsive to that feedback. Mm-hmm. Russ uses the example of what was it, Votizen, to kind of illustrate this point.
Oh yeah, Votizen. They started as this social network for verified voters, and they got some initial traction, you know, but it wasn't really sustainable, that growth. So instead of just stubbornly sticking to their original plan, they actually ended up pivoting multiple times. Like they experimented with different features, pricing models, even different target audiences.
So they went through a lot of trial and error, but it sounds like their story really highlights the importance of being adaptable.
Yeah.
Did they end up finding success?
They did. Through all those pivots, they eventually found a business model that worked. And well, their journey is really a testament to, the power of persistence and being willing to just let go of ideas that just aren't working.
It's really inspiring to see how they use those lean startup principles to navigate all those challenges. Speaking of principles, Reese also talks about finding the right engine of growth for your startup. What exactly does he mean by that?
So an engine of growth is basically the mechanism that, that really drives customer acquisition. Reese identifies four main ones: the sticky engine, the viral engine, the paid engine, and then the repeat purchase or use engine.
Okay, so that's quite a few engines.
Yeah.
Can you break down, what are the key characteristics of each one?
Sure. So the sticky engine, that's all about, creating a product that people just love to use and they keep coming back to. So it's about high engagement, low churn. Think Facebook.
Yeah, they've definitely got that down.
Right, people spend hours on there. So that's a sticky engine. Then there's the viral engine, which, well, that relies on the power of word of mouth and social sharing. So it's about creating a product that people just naturally want to tell their friends about. A classic example is Hotmail. Back in the day, they added that little tagline, "Get your free email at Hotmail," to every outgoing email, and boom, instant growth. People just organically spread the word.
That's so clever. I mean, leveraging virality to drive growth. That's amazing. Okay, what about the paid engine? When is that the right approach?
So the paid engine, that's using things like advertising to get customers, right? So it's common for companies with high customer lifetime value, where the cost to acquire a customer is offset by their long-term value. Think, software companies with subscription models, things like that.
Right, makes sense. Okay, and then last but not least, the repeat purchase or use engine.
Right. So this one is about products that customers just naturally, buy or use over and over again. So think subscription services, things like Netflix or Spotify, consumable goods, or even things that need to be replaced regularly, like printer ink.
So the key is to figure out which engine aligns best with your product and, and your business model.
Exactly. And Rees really emphasizes the importance of focusing on just one engine at a time, because if you try to do too many things at once, well, you just end up spreading your resources too thin, and then it just leads to confusion and inefficiency.
Right. And this all really, it ties back to that principle of validated learning, doesn't it?
It does.
You experiment, you get data, and then you adapt based on what you learn. It's just this continuous process of refining and improving.
Yep, you got it. And that whole process, it's not just about, making those big decisions like pivoting or picking an engine of growth. It's also about those, those day-to-day operations. Reese actually goes into some really practical concepts that can help to streamline development and actually accelerate the whole learning process.
Okay, so let's dive into some of those practical concepts. And one that you mentioned earlier was small batches,
Right?
which sounds like something, borrowed from the world of manufacturing.
Yeah, you're totally right. It comes from lean manufacturing principles, and it's really all about, breaking down work into like smaller, more manageable chunks.
Okay, so I get how that works in like a factory, but how does that apply to startups?
Okay, so imagine you're building this, this really complex piece of software. Instead of trying to build the whole thing at once, which could take like forever, you break it down into smaller features or,
So
modules.
you're creating a bunch of mini projects that you can like complete and test more quickly.
Exactly. By working in small batches, you reduce that risk of, investing a lot of time and money in something that just doesn't work. You're getting feedback more frequently, and then you can just, you can adapt more easily.
So it's minimizing waste, maximizing learning.
Yeah.
Can you give us like an example of how this works, like in real life?
Sure. Reese talks about his own company, IMVU. They were building that 3D avatar technology, right? So instead of trying to build this perfect, like fully functional version up front, they started with this really basic version where the avatars, they couldn't even walk. Like they would just teleport from one spot to another.
That sounds kind of funny, but I guess it served its purpose.
It did. It allowed them to just get feedback quickly, and they learned that people really valued the ability to, to actually move their avatars around. So then they prioritized that feature in those later versions.
So they were prioritizing learning over, over perfection.
Exactly. And this principle, it's not just for like product development. You can use it for, marketing experiments, sales processes, even hiring.
I'm starting to see how this could be like a really powerful mindset shift.
It is, and it really does go hand in hand with another key concept, continuous deployment.
Continuous deployment. That sounds a little intimidating. Can you explain what that is?
Sure, think of it like this. Imagine getting feedback from your customers, not just once a month or once a week, but like every single day. That's continuous deployment. It's about releasing updates, new features to your product as often as possible, sometimes even multiple times per day.
Wait, so you're constantly like pushing out new code to your users. Doesn't that sound kind of risky? What if there are bugs?
Well, yeah, it can be risky, but the key is to have, really good testing and a culture of quality. You're not just like throwing code out there and hoping for the best, right?
So it's about being like disciplined and having safeguards in place. But what are the benefits of releasing updates that often?
Well, it allows you to get feedback way faster, which means you learn faster. You can see how people are using the new features and you can make adjustments based on that. It's like having this like constant stream of data coming in to inform your decisions.
I can see how that connects back to that build, measure, learn cycle. It's about like closing that feedback loop as fast as you can.
Exactly. And continuous deployment also, it helps to prevent technical debt from building up. When you're releasing smaller changes more often, well, it's just easier to like spot and fix problems before they become these, these huge
So
issues.
it's like keeping your code base nice and clean, right?
Yeah.
Preventing those messy technical tangles.
That's a great way to put it. And it's not just about like speed, it's about creating an organization that can be more responsive and adaptable. Rees gives a great example of this with Wealthfront.
Wealthfront. Okay.
Yeah, so they're a financial services company, which means they operate in, in a really highly regulated environment. So you'd think things would move pretty slowly there, right?
Right.
But they've actually embraced continuous deployment. They're releasing updates to their platform multiple times every day.
Wow, that's impressive. It shows that even those companies in those traditionally like slow-moving industries, they can still benefit from these principles.
Absolutely. And it's a key part of making the lean startup method work because it lets companies learn and adapt so much faster. But sometimes even with all this, even with continuous deployment and rapid iteration, things still go wrong. And when they do, it's super important to like to really understand why. And that's where that five whys technique comes in.
Okay, you mentioned that the five whys technique earlier. Can you remind us how that works?
Sure. It's actually really simple. It's deceptively simple, but it's really powerful. It's all about asking why five times in a row, each time getting a little deeper into the root cause of the problem.
So it's like peeling back the layers of an onion to get to the core of the issue.
Exactly. Let's say, for example, a startup is having a high churn rate. People are canceling their subscriptions like crazy.
Okay, so how would you use the five whys in that situation? Like,
Yeah.
walk us through it.
Okay, so we start by asking why are people canceling? And let's say the answer is they're not finding the product valuable.
Okay, so that's the first why. What's next?
Right. Then we ask why aren't they finding it valuable? And maybe the answer is, well, they're not using those key features that, deliver the most value.
Interesting. Okay, so we're starting to see a pattern here. What's the next question?
Right. So then it's why aren't they using those features? And maybe the answer is, well, the features are just they're too hard to use.
So maybe there's a usability problem.
Yeah, exactly. And we dig a little deeper. So we ask, why are those features so hard to use? And the answer might be, well, the onboarding process doesn't really explain how to use them.
So we've gone from this like high-level problem of churn to a very specific issue with the onboarding process. We've got one more why to go.
Right. So then we ask, why doesn't the onboarding process explain how to use the features? And maybe the answer is, well, we haven't really invested enough in creating those clear and user-friendly tutorials.
So we started with a pretty broad problem and we've ended up with a really specific, like actionable insight. It's amazing how a technique that simple can help you pinpoint the root cause.
It really is. It helps you move beyond those surface symptoms and you identify those underlying issues that might be contributing to the problem.
And this isn't just for startups, right? Like anyone could use this.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's a universal problem-solving tool. You can use it anywhere. And Rees gives some great advice on, how to actually use it effectively.
Okay, so what are his top tips?
Well, first of all, make sure that everyone who's involved in the problem is actually involved in the five whys session, because it's important to get all those different perspectives, right? And then second, make sure you're making a proportional investment at each level. So, the investment should match the severity of the symptom. And finally, appoint a he calls it a five whys master to kind of facilitate the process and make sure that that those action items actually get done.
Those are great tips. Really sounds like the five whys is about like creating that culture of accountability and, continuous learning.
Yeah, exactly. It's about creating a system where problems, well, they're seen as opportunities to, to improve, not just things to be swept under the rug.
So we've
Right.
talked about small batches, continuous deployment, and the five whys. Those are all really practical and useful tools for any organization. But there's one more piece of the puzzle, right? The organizational structure and culture.
You're right. Rees goes beyond those tactics, and he actually dives into the organizational context that makes the lean startup method successful. He talks about creating what he calls innovation sandboxes within larger organizations.
Okay, innovation sandbox. Now I'm picturing like a literal sandbox,
Yeah.
but I'm guessing it's a metaphor.
It is. It's like, imagine a protected space within a company where teams can experiment and innovate without being, without being held back by all that bureaucracy and risk aversion that you see in, in bigger
So it's
companies.
like creating a mini startup within the company.
Exactly. It's about giving those teams the freedom, the autonomy, and the resources they need to try new things and learn fast. Rees uses Intuit as an example. They've used innovation sandboxes to develop some really successful new products.
This sounds crucial for like established companies, right? The ones that want to stay ahead of the curve, the ones that, that don't want to be disrupted by all these like these new agile startups.
It is. It's about creating that culture where experimentation is encouraged, even if it leads to failure sometimes, because, failure is a part of learning.
It's that fail fast, learn fast mentality.
Exactly. And it's not just about like the structure, it's also about the mindset and the leadership.
So what kind of leadership does it take to, to really foster that lean startup culture?
Well, lean startup leaders, they need to be okay with uncertainty. They need to be able to empower their teams, encourage experimentation, and they need to be data-driven, focused on that validated learning, not just gut feelings.
It sounds like a different kind of leadership than what you typically see.
It is. It's about being more of a like a facilitator and a coach, not just a, a commander.
So Rees is giving us a roadmap, not just for building products, but for building organizations, right? Organizations that are adaptable, innovative, and customer-centric.
Exactly. The lean startup, it's a holistic approach, and it requires a real shift in how we think about work, management, all of
And he acknowledges that, that this isn't always easy to do, especially in those companies that have been around for a long time, the ones that have those deeply ingrained cultures and processes.
Right. He actually addresses those challenges head on, and he offers some really good advice on, how to overcome them. It's about persistence and finding ways to, to introduce those principles gradually, demonstrating their value along the way.
It's a journey, not a destination.
It is.
And it's a journey worth taking because, well, because the lean startup method has the potential to unlock so much, so much innovation, so much agility.
I totally agree. It's about creating a culture where you're constantly learning and adapting, which is, I mean, it's essential these days, right? The world is changing so fast.
Right.
And speaking of the changing world, Rees doesn't just focus on, on the internal workings of companies. He also looks at like the bigger picture, the societal implications of this whole movement.
That's a great point. And that's a great segue into the final part of our deep dive. I think we've covered a lot of ground, but there's still more to explore. Let's take a quick break here and come back to dive into, into Rees's broader perspective on the lean startup and its implications for the future. So we've explored a lot of the nuts and bolts of the lean startup method. But as you said, Rees doesn't, he doesn't stop there. He kind of connects all of this to this bigger idea of, innovation and entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
So what's his overall perspective?
Well, he makes this argument that, we're living in this time where there's just this incredible opportunity for innovation, right? But there's also like A ton of waste.
Right.
We celebrate all the successes, but we don't always, you know, we don't always see all the failures, all the products and companies that, you know, that just don't make it.
You know, it's easy to, to get caught up in all the excitement of like new ideas and stuff. But, the reality is not everything is going to work out. So what does Rise, what does he think causes all this waste?
He says it's because of, you know, these old management practices,
Yeah.
the ones that haven't really kept up with, you know, with how fast things change now and all the uncertainty. Those old ways of doing things, they were designed for a different time, you know, when things moved slower and the markets were more predictable.
It's like trying to navigate a speedboat through rapids with it, like with a map for a sailboat, right?
Exactly. You need different tools, and you need a different mindset. And Rees, he sees the lean startup as this necessary change in how we think about management. It's this framework that, you know, that embraces all that uncertainty, the experimentation, the constant learning. It's perfect for, you know, for the challenges we face now.
And it seems like this approach is really rooted in, in those principles of lean manufacturing that we've been talking about.
Oh, absolutely. He gets a lot of inspiration from the Toyota production system. You know, the focus on eliminating waste and being as efficient as possible. He even talks about this Japanese concept, Gentu Genbutsu. It basically means, you know, go and see for yourself.
So it's about like getting out of the office, going out into the world, and seeing how people are actually using your product.
Yeah. And it's not just about like watching, you know, it's about talking to your customers, asking them questions, really trying to understand what they need and what motivates them.
It makes me think of those, those early experiments we were talking about with like Zappos and
Yeah.
food on the table. They were basically doing that, right?
Totally. And that principle, it's not just for startups. As companies get bigger, it's even more important to keep that connection with your customers, to get their feedback, to adapt.
It's about building that culture of, of constantly learning and being customer focused. But Rees doesn't just talk about what happens inside companies, right? He looks at like the bigger picture, the impact on society.
Right. He argues that this lean startup method, it could lead to this whole wave of like innovation and entrepreneurship, which could, you know, could lead to economic growth and social progress. He imagines a world where, you know, where those principles of validated learning and constant innovation are applied everywhere, not just in businesses, like in government, in education, even in personal development.
So it's like a fundamental shift in how we approach like problem solving and decision making in every area of life, basically. It's about like being willing to experiment, to challenge our assumptions, to
Yeah.
always be looking for a better way.
Exactly. And he even suggests some really radical ideas, like creating a long-term stock exchange where companies are rewarded for, you know, for long-term growth, not just short-term profits.
That's a fascinating idea.
Yeah.
It would definitely like make companies think differently about their goals. It really shows that the lean startup, it's not just like a bunch of tools. It's a way of thinking. It can
Yeah.
really challenge the way our whole economic system works.
Right. And that's what makes The Lean Startup such a thought-provoking book. It's not just about like starting a business. It's about, you know, it's about thinking differently about how we solve problems and create value.
This has been an incredible deep dive. We've covered so much, the principles, the practical stuff, and then, the bigger picture, the impact on individuals and organizations and society as a whole.
The Lean Startup, it's full of like really practical advice, inspiring stories, and insights that can help, well, they can help anyone who's, you know, who's trying to create something new.
If you're ready to, to embrace the uncertainty, to challenge your assumptions and to really start that journey of continuous learning, well, this book is it's a must read.
And remember, it's not just about like being successful, it's about, you know, it's about that process, experimenting, learning from your mistakes, and adapting.
It's that build, measure, learn cycle
Yeah.
over and over again.
Yeah.
It's a journey.
It is. And as you know, as you start that journey, remember what Eric Ries said. The only way to win is to learn faster than anyone else.
Well said. We hope you've enjoyed this deep dive into the lean startup. And if you want to, if you want to keep learning and exploring these groundbreaking ideas, make sure you subscribe to the deep dive. We'll see you next time.